Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 478. And I'm joined today by someone I was very excited to talk to. Someone who I've met once, and it was 10 years ago. And I felt we really got on well and we've kind of kept in touch. But it's mad that it's taken us 10 years to sit down and have a proper chat. So, yeah, I'm joined today by Jim Bob from Carter, the Unstoppable Sex Machine. An iconic band of that kind of early 90s, mid-90s era in UK music. And also a wonderful writer and generally great bloke. Jim Bob was someone, I did a tweet a few weeks back asking who people would like to hear on the pod. And Jim Bob was one of the people requested there. 90% of those, or no, let's say 40% of those are people that I'm either not aware of or I don't think are a good fit for the podcast, so I awkwardly don't respond to. I'd say 50% are guests I've already had on, and I reply saying, good news, I've already had them on, so you can listen to them now. Enjoy! And 10% is people I'd love to have on and respond to. No, actually 5% of that and 5% are people I've not got a chance of getting on or I've got no contact for or whatever else. So that's the split of those tweets and Instagram posts. It's why I don't do them very often, because as I said, most of my time is spent going, good news! They've already been on and you can enjoy listening to it right now. Enjoy! Anyway, speaking of enjoying, I'll get on with this bloody podcast so you can enjoy. We're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Really brief thing here. In response to the shit times we're in, I've reduced almost everything on the website. So everything on the website is cheaper, except for a couple of things that we've only just ordered and can't afford to cut the price down on. I did a video about it, explaining it all, explaining the reason for the price that we came to, that we can reduce things by. This isn't a temporary sale. This is the permanent price of all of these things until we sell out of them. So head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com if there was something you wanted to buy but were holding off until it was cheaper, because it's cheaper now. But in reality, none of it's important. There's far more important things going on at the moment that you probably need to spend your money on. But yeah, if you did want to get anything over there, the bulk of it is cheaper. We're also brought to you by patreon.com/ScroobiousPip, where you can just throw in $1 a month to help pay for this podcast, to help buy, let's go with Muesli for Buddy Peace. I pay him in Muesli and stuff like that. And you can also catch me over on Twitch. You lot know Twitch is the thing I'm probably enjoying the most at the moment, publicly. That sounded really ominous. Publicly, privately, there's a lot of things I'm enjoying. But publicly, the thing I'm enjoying the most at the moment is Twitch. Head over there, twitch.tv/ScroobiousPipyo. I'm on a lot, man. And I put everything together, like the VODs, the on-demand stuff. I put loads of it together in little series. So if you look over at the collections, like, you can catch up on specific series I'm doing over there. That's about it, isn't it? Let's get on with the podcast. As said, I was delighted to talk to Jim Bob, and we had a really good chat. He's so open and honest, and he shone a lot of lights on stuff I wasn't too aware of. And he's just good to talk to. So I hope you enjoy this. This is episode 478 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Jim Bob. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Right, I'm here today with Jim Bob. How are you, sir?
Good. Bit bunged up.
A bit bunged up. It's that time of year, isn't it? It's as if it turns October 1st and the weather, our health, everything goes right. No, it's autumn.
Bunged up in the nose, by the way, not bunged up elsewhere. could be a different kind of bunged up, couldn't it?
Yeah, it very much could. How do you? I was thinking this before we got started. Do you get affected much by all the bullshit in the world these days? I personally find I used to get affected a lot more. I think I've got a quicker shut off, switch off from everything in my head. But obviously, living in the UK at the moment, there's a lot of nonsense going on.
Yeah.
How does that hit you?
I'd say, everything bothers me. Probably similar things that always bothered me, but maybe they bother me for a shorter period of time.
Yeah.
I find it easier to kind of move on.
Yeah.
You know,
The same.
I'm not consumed by anger.
Yeah. I think you hit an automatic cut off earlier for your own sanity, for your own mental health, these things as you get a bit older, because it is just, it's relentless.
It really is, yeah. Especially it's mostly social media, isn't it? I think if I wasn't on social media, I think I probably just wouldn't know what was going on.
Yeah, 100%. I agree so much. And it's such a double-edged sword, because I'm not a fan of social media anymore in general, but I do worry that I need a little bit of that constant anger, because there's a lot to constantly be angry about. And I completely agree. If I wasn't on there, I'd probably just be at home watching films and that and going, everything's all right, isn't it? The world's okay, isn't it? It's not too bad. I think I'd miss completely out on all the stuff I should be getting angry about.
Yeah. Somebody actually pulled me up on it quite late last night on Twitter, that why wasn't I saying anything about the Tories and stuff?
Yeah.
And that I was self-obsessed, just constantly talking about, you know, my records and my tour and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I thought, it bothered me more than it should, because people don't tend to have a go at me on Twitter.
Yeah.
So it was sort of unusual. And so I sort of just looked back at what I'd said recently, and it was just basically, I'm in the studio, recording vocals today, tour's on sale. That is pretty much the occasional joke. But then I thought, you know, do we need more people saying the same thing?
Well, that's exactly it. I genuinely think I've had that once or twice, and my response is always, look, I've written a few political songs over the years. I've certainly had loads of rants on social media. Nothing's changed. I've got nothing to add to that. You should know from my previous back catalogue or tweets or whatever else that I think they're a bunch of cunts, but there's no benefit of me adding my voice to those who are articulating it better or getting actual facts and stats across and all these other things.
Yeah.
Sometimes, I do need to just say fuck the Tories, but in general, I know that's not adding much. That's just purely, that's as self-centred in a way.
And also because you are in like your own bubble, presumably vast amount, most people who are like following your tweets, say, for example, are probably like in agreement anyway. So I remember when I was a teenager and I was signing on and I was at the Dole and they used to sell the Socialist Worker outside. And for some reason at that time, it always used to irritate me because I felt that they were like selling it in the wrong place.
Yeah,
kind of thing. You know, sort of, I don't know, it always sort of bothered me that they should be selling it outside Conservative Party headquarters or something.
I always remember me and Dan Lesac had a song on our first album that was kind of about how stagnant UK hip-hop had become. And it wasn't really having a go. It was just saying, look, you can do a lot more. And we got a gig supporting Lethal Bizzle at one of his album launches, and he was like peak UK hip hop at that time, and I really enjoyed his stuff, so it was a good gig. But we ummed and erred, and we're like, no, we have to play it to this crowd, because it's bullshit that we've been playing it to all our little hipsters at our gigs, and now we're in front of UK hip hop fans, the members of the community, the rappers. It'd be stupid, it'd be bullshit to not play it here. And we played it, and it got a very mixed reaction. It was literally, it was weird where people were stood, because literally half the room was enjoying it and the other half were standing there like, fuck off, mate. But again, it felt important, because exactly as you say, it's so easy to just go, I'm going to play it over here, and they're all going to go, similarly, I'm going to tell the socialist outside the job seeker's place and all that, and not fucking to the people on the other side who need to hear about it. So yeah, I get that. It's a weird balance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's weird. All of social media is weird. I've got no answers.
No. I mean, we should just leave it, shouldn't we, obviously?
Exactly. And that's the problem. I worry about moaning about it too much on here when I'm on it still.
Yeah.
So I can't, I've got no right to keep saying it's shit. Just leave, and I haven't, so it's on me. But social media aside, there's loads I want to talk to you about, but I thought a good place to start would be kind of how we met. Because we both did, about 10 years ago now. We both did a Six Music, like it was a round table thing. And I always feel cautious accepting those things because, and they're not, it's like this isn't a criticism of them or any of the people who organise it. I always feel I'm kind of meant to come on and slag songs off and be edgy and be nasty. And I don't like that. I'd rather talk about the songs I'm into and leave the ones I'm not into. Because again, particularly as like we talked about, we should leave social media. As now, a 40-year-old man, a lot of the new pop music isn't for me. So I don't want to be grumpy old man on the radio going, this isn't as good as the songs I used to like. And I just felt that I was really pleased to meet you there and we kind of felt like we were in a similar mindset and position.
Yeah. I mean, I was on it last week or the week before, funnily enough. I hadn't been on it for ages. And I kind of feel, I found myself just doing it for laughs.
Yeah.
And sort of, it wasn't my plan. I just thought I'd just be nice about everyone. But then that's boring, isn't it? So I find sort of, it's better to just almost kind of ignore the songs and the records.
Yeah.
And just sort of generally take the piss. And
just
hopefully,
go on and piss about.
Basically entertain.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's, you know, it's people just saying, oh, it's not my cup of tea or talking about the drum sound or something. It's you know, it's a potentially an incredibly boring show, isn't it?
Yeah, it can get proper into itself. And I always, again, I think that's part as well. I've always felt like an absolute fraud in music because all I do is speak lyrics. And it was always the people I worked with who knew all the insides and outs of drum sounds and all this kind of thing. So I'm always going, yeah, it sounds all right.
Yeah. I'm still a bit like that, to be honest with you. So I've been recording some new stuff lately.
Yeah.
And I've had a couple of people come in, like somebody came in and played trumpet and sax, and we had somebody come in and play violin. And as soon as they ask a question about, you know, sixths or sevenths or something, or some sort of chord change, and I'm totally lost, you know.
I love it. I always remember bumping into Mark Ronson at a festival, and we'd supported him early days, and he was headlining this festival, and he came up just before he went on, and I was a bit pissed. He came up just before he went on and went, oh, do you want to come on and do a verse in one of our songs? And I was like, yeah. He was like, well, do 8 bars, stand side stage, and I'll call you. And I was like, yeah, okay. And then I ran to find Dan Lesac and said, how much is 8 bars? Because I don't know. And I just basically started doing the verse I wanted to do, and he was like, stop there, that's 8 bars. Like, cool, perfect. Again, just clueless on that kind of thing. I was like, okay, I'll go and do that, and I know where to stop now.
Well, that's why we're geniuses, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. We're not swamped down by analysis and the technicalities. When we were on that round table, you were there promoting Storage Stories.
Right.
And I loved that book. And you've had many books over the years now. What was your kind of transition into writing stories and things like that? I always remember the karaoke hustler story in there that just had me in absolute bits. Yeah, what was your route into writing these odd little tales?
It was, the boring story is that I wrote the wrote Carter memoir. I struggle with the word memoir because it's ridiculous, isn't it? My background also makes me sound like I'm being pretentious using a French word.
Yeah.
But when I wrote that Carter autobiography, let's say.
Yeah.
And after I'd written that, and it was quite a sort of pleasurable thing to have a book out. So I think that made me want to write another one. And I had nothing else to say about myself. So I started writing a novel, and it took years. And that became Storage Stories.
Yeah.
So I don't think there was any massive desire to do it. You know, I just kind of stumbled into it, like I tend to do with a lot of things.
Yeah.
And that led to me writing more novels. And again, at a certain point, a few years ago, I stopped doing that and went back to music. So I realised I can't do both at the same time.
Right.
I think it's just probably because of the wordy nature of my songs, maybe.
Yeah.
Because they're sort of quite wordy that I haven't got enough words in my head to sort of
I love that it's like if I'm doing both at the same time, this song will quickly become a novel, and then I've not got anything left for the song.
Or one of the art forms is going to suffer.
Exactly. I love it. Well, I want to kind of rewind all the way back and talk about everything, but this is the point. I have a kind of an awkward confession that I missed Carter. I was too young. My brother was a massive fan, but that period of Carter, of the Wonder Stuff, of EMF, was when I was at that age that I had shit taste in music and hadn't yet started stealing all my music tastes off my brother, which then came on and has continued. Everything I've ever been into since has come off my older brother. But it meant I missed that period. But it's kind of made me excited to talk about it with you because, you know, it's all quite fresh to me. But ahead of all of that, you said about your background. You grew up in South London, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And how was that kind of growing up? Like all my family are from South London. That era, growing up in South London, kind of, I guess, end of punk fizzling out. What was your life in that time?
Well, I was there at the, I mean, punk-wise, I was there at the beginning of the whole, you know, I was there for the whole thing. I was at school. I mean, before that, like, I was always into, I think when I was about 13 or 14, I got really into music. And a bit like you with your brother, it was I didn't have a brother, but my sister's boyfriends. I used to kind of like her music. So I got into, I was really into ska when I was nine. Yeah. I just remember being like nine.
Amazing.
And just because, you know, just sort of hanging out with these sort of skinhead mates.
I love it.
her older boy, you know, later on I got into heavy rock because her boyfriends liked AC/DC or something, you know. So it was all these sort of things. And then when I was at school, I sort of met people who also liked music and I got into the music that they liked, which was, you know, so I went through these sort of, looking back on it, quite short periods of really intensely being into stuff. So like really madly into rock and roll for a short period of time and being in a rock and roll, but, you know, like playing Buddy Holly and Elvis Presley and sort of Eddie Cochran songs.
I love that, though. I love the intensity at that age of you falling into like a genre, but also it was a pre-internet time because I've got the same. I've had loads of things where I was like, I was massively into metal at that point. I was like, oh no, I had three metal albums because that's all I could afford. And that was all my knowledge was of that. Cause...
And it's such a short period that when you think back, it's you'd think it's a long period of time. So I think like, well, I kind of liked Queen then because I was really into like punk then. And I sort of, you know, I turned my back on all that and you think, no, it's the same year, you know.
I still
like Rod Stewart in the same year. I like the Sex Pistols.
I have that with Oasis. It's like I had a sudden memory that I remember being on the train to school and listening to Oasis a lot. But at that period, I was into punk and slight kind of post-punk stuff. I was like, oh no, exactly as you say. I was into it for a couple of months.
Yeah.
When the first album came out, and then I was against it all because I didn't. Yeah. I turned on the Britpop stuff because I was like, no, I'm into this now. But it's mad the intensity of those moments.
Yeah, I think it's probably when I was like late teen, you know, like maybe 17 or that I really sort of started taking it more seriously and knew what I liked. The stuff that I liked sort of stuck with me.
Well, you touched upon bands, though. You started getting in bands quite early, right? You and Fruitbat. Like, did you meet at school and were straight off kind of let's start making?
No, I was we did sort of live relatively close. He's slightly older than me, but we lived sort of quite close to each other, but didn't know each other. It wasn't till I was in a band, I think at the time we were called the Ballpoints.
Right.
I was in a lot of bands that didn't do anything other than rehearse. We just used to, and we went to this rehearsal studio in Streatham in South London. It was kind of like it was a bit of a weird place. It was a lot of people just should hang out there, and it was really like a cool place to be and go to the pub together with everyone from the bands. And
at that kind of age, being in a band is mainly coming up with a really good name.
Yeah, yeah.
Deciding who the band members are.
Yeah.
Not too much more than that is important, really.
Make one badge.
Yeah, exactly. draw up a potential album sleeve.
Maybe, got all the titles for the first album.
Exactly.
And then Les was just in one of the other bands, and
he
just ended up playing bass with my band and sort of followed on there, being with various different incarnations of bands, with me and him being the sort of two constant members. Just shredding other people.
I love it. Just working through everyone. So when was it that Carter, the Unstoppable Sex Machine, again, you at that age, you're coming up with good band names, you came up with a cracker. when was it that became the focus, I guess?
We were in a band. The first band that actually made records was Jamie Wednesday, me and Les were in. And it was kind of sort of run its course for us slightly. We were sort of, because we were quite... We were sort of part of that scene where the Pogues and Mendicant Hang, that kind of stuff, which we were really, really into at the time. And then we got, like, Les in particular, Fruitbat was really into, like, LL Cool J and Public Enemy and stuff like that. So and AC/DC. So he was kind of, the music we were making had nothing to do with the music he was making. And I was really into things like Tom Waits and the band of Holy Joy, really basically lyric-y sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I think we decided to split the band up, but we went ahead with our, we had a gig, some charity gig at the Astoria in London.
Yeah.
So we just went ahead with a gig, and I think we told the promoter like the day before or something, we've split the band up, can we go ahead and play with our new band? And that was like the first car. And we kind of did it very quickly. So we had, we didn't have any other band members, and we knew we wanted to use Drum Machine. And so we just recorded some backing tracks with like drums and bass, and we wrote them really quickly and just, yeah. So it was one of those things. It was a sort of necessity that we had to, we had a gig.
I love the speed of that, that you had a gig booked with the other band. And before it came about, you're like, well, that's not a thing anymore. We're doing this now. Just honestly, it'll work.
I think we wrote the first songs in the first gig songs in probably like a week or something. And brilliant. Recorded them. And so, you know, some of them stayed, some of them ended up being on records later on.
Quite quickly, it felt like you got a good reputation as a live band, and just for gigs, like a good live following, a good rowdy, interactive kind of fan base, right?
Yeah, because we didn't have, you know, once we'd started making records, we didn't get played on the radio for whatever reason. Yeah. We didn't get that much press. Later on we did, but at first we didn't really get any music press. So we just carried on just doing gigs. And we got a manager quite early on. He wasn't a band manager. He just decided he wanted to manage us. He worked on a flower stall. And our sort of enthusiasm and lack of experience, we just decided to do what we wanted to do, which was just do lots and lots of gigs everywhere, mostly avoiding London. We decided not to play in London. Because if we played in London, we would just play to our friends and family.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'd rather play to, you know, seven strangers in Bolton than 10 people we knew in London.
It's mad. I did exactly that when I started off. I toured around the whole country living in a van. And just for that exact reason, partly, it was far scarier to me to play in front of people I know than to play in front of strangers. Yeah, totally. But also, I'd seen so many local bands who got that local band syndrome of they play in front of their mates every week and they start to think they're huge.
Yeah.
Or they stop pushing as hard as they could because they think, oh, we're brilliant. Everyone's telling us we're great. And then they go out of town and play to two people and crumble. I was much more on the, no, I want to start with that. I want to go out of town and play to these, you know, in random areas. Yeah.
Without sort of being patronising, condescending to people who don't live in London, it was kind of, I think it was appreciated.
Yeah. Yeah,
that you would 100%. Sort of, you know what I mean, that you'd sort of make a bit of effort.
And there's always that assumption that, they must be big and successful if they're coming up this way kind of thing. I definitely had that I had hardly played in London at all, and I built a decent following in the rest of the UK because I really worked hard on my live show. I had a polished live show. I had a little bit of some printed out CDs or whatever else, so people would assume, oh, he must be big down south.
Yeah.
Like, nah, I've never, no one that down south knows I'm doing this, but yeah, it's a good it's a good trick.
Yeah, and it kind of worked outside of, you know, outside the UK as well. We did, or not even just outside the UK, but playing in sort of unusual places, you know, playing a lot of gigs in Eastern Europe and stuff like that. Places where people weren't really going on tour, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, the former Yugoslavia and stuff like that, sort of. Yeah. Places where people didn't go as part of a tour because there wasn't a record market. I think that's why people go places, isn't it, when they're in bands?
Yeah.
They're just promoting something.
Where can we chart and so on and so forth? I mean, speaking of promoting something, that era, and again, this is partly because of looking up at my brother and his mates and all these kind of things, it felt like a really big era for band t-shirts. I've definitely heard about you guys on t-shirts before anything else, before I heard any music. And it's weird because it feels like that isn't as much of a thing anymore, other than metal bands. Metal from the beginning and until the end is always going to be about band t-shirts as well. Yeah. But yeah, that felt like a really good era for all of of you guys of really getting these, yeah, these cool band t-shirts out, and people really wearing it as their identity and as a statement of their tastes and who they are. So how was that?
Oh, it's great. I mean, at the time it was great because it was just, you know, it's how we paid to put petrol in the car or whatever to get to the gig.
Of course.
But I don't really sort of remember it being such a big thing at the time. I know it was, you know, but and we had sort of a lot of battles with bootleg t-shirt people and stuff, and also bigger companies that wanted to, you know, buy us out. We sort of resisted that. I mean, I think the thing is that the good thing now is that it's still, you know, people still want to wear those shirts, so they still rebuy them, which is it's kind of probably what I've lived off more than anything else in recent years. Not that you know, not the music, you know, don't make any money from the old records, but do still make money from you know, the money that I'd make now from this, not that it's just about money, but the money I'd make from, say, 30 something shirts compared to the 30 something record. Mm-hmm. Is probably insane, the difference between the two.
Yeah, 100%. And I love the idea. I always remember me and Dan Lesak would stand out when we were doing gigs with other bands or like on a city festival or whatever, because similarly, we were a guy with a drum machine, a laptop and that kind of thing, and a vocalist. So our actual kit didn't take a lot of loading in, but our merch... was most of what we were loading in. So all these other bands have got to get all their kit in, and we're like, where do we put our boxes of merch? Because that's all that's actually in the back here. And again, it must have been similar with you guys at that period with
a
guitar and a drum machine and then a fuckload of boxes of t-shirts.
Yeah. I think there probably was a moment somewhere in there when we were quite successful where probably would, you know, we'd start to have disagreements with our manager. Because we felt like he was more interested in selling shirts, which wasn't true. But you know, sometimes it feels like that. Well, what about this new songs?
Yeah,
yeah.
It's a funny one though, because as you say, from the manager point of view, particularly in this era, but equally back then, you're not making loads from record sales. Obviously, the songs are the key part for building the fan base, but for being able to do this as your job, as working class people. You know, things. It's those other things. It's those add-on bits that you know, your songs are what will get people through the door. But as you say, it's the t-shirts that are going to pay the petrol money and the hotel rooms and all those other bits.
You know, now it's a sort of big thing again, isn't it? About people are sort of talking about the you know, venues taking a massive percentage of your t-shirt sales, not realizing what a big deal that is.
Yeah,
they just think, you know, we're giving you some space, so we'll charge you for it. Don't realise how they could effectively be saying, well, you can't play it. You can't play her anymore.
Yeah, you know? I just about missed most of that. Just at the point of stopping touring was when they were starting to bring that in. And I was fuming because I ran the merch booth myself. We made all the merch ourselves, all that kind of thing. It's like, I could understand them getting a cut if they're putting a person to sell the stuff for us or whatever else. But it's like, no, this is all me. This is... I'll sell it from the van out the front if you're gonna be a dick about it.
But if they do supply a person, even that can be worse, you know, because we've had that, been on tours where they supply a person, but you still have to take the person who's selling them at the gigs where they haven't got a person. So you've got someone who's doing nothing.
Yeah.
And the person they supply is so disinterested in the whole thing.
Yeah.
Has never heard of the band because they're like 15 years old or whatever.
Yeah.
And doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And then... So it's kind of, that's even worse if they do supply someone, I think, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just irritating. I think all these things I find irritating, like these are things that do annoy me that aren't necessarily that important. Like dynamic ticket pricing, you know, that whole sort of thing that people charging, you know, treating it like a flight or something rather than a gig, and charging more if the tickets are in demand, that kind of stuff.
That's horrific. It doesn't make any sense to me.
But the same as that and t-shirts, sort of merch, sort of commission, I just think the really big acts could pretty much stop that, couldn't they?
Yeah.
But they obviously don't, you know, I don't believe, so when, you know, people say, oh, it's not really up to Bruce Springsteen or it's not up to One Direction or whatever to decide how much their tickets are sold for, but that's just bollocks, isn't it? There's no way.
It is. It's 100%
up to them. Of course they could say, no, well, all right, we're not doing it.
Yeah. And I completely understand the whole, well, depending on the act, it might be really expensive to put on the show. Like, it's cheaper for me to go and play a pub than for Bruce Springsteen to bring the fucking E Street Band and pay everyone well and things like that. But that can be part of the discussion. It shouldn't be just a, well, let's not look at it because it's different, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, well, no, if it is different, then we can take that into account. But, you know, it should be, as you say, they're the ones who have the power to make to make change.
Because I sort of moaned, something I did moan about on Twitter recently about that, and people were sort of telling me, oh, it's not up to the acts and that. But then at the same time, Paul Heaton was doing his gigs, and they're sort of like big, like he's doing the O2 and that, stuff like that, and they're maximum £30 a ticket.
Yeah.
All tickets.
Yeah.
So if he can do it, why can't somebody as massive as Bruce Springsteen do it? Because supposedly he has no power. It's just.
We literally, from early days, we just told our booking agent that we want to keep our tickets between 10 and 20 quid.
Yeah.
And that was it. That's how hard it was to take control and get that done. And we had that for our whole career.
Well, you have that discussion, and you know, they say, like, what are we going to charge? And then they suggest something or you suggest something, and you come to some agreement.
Yeah.
They don't say, oh, no, sorry, we're going to have to charge 500 quid ticket because it's nothing to do with you.
I'm afraid you've not got a say in this. Oh, no, I have. It's mine. Yeah. It's a weird one. Well, I mean, you touched upon when things got more successful. How was it when everything blew up? Because you guys got huge. I remember my brother going off to see you headline either Reading or a stage at Glastonbury or whatever else. And as you say, you were coming out of an era where a band is one or two guitarists, a bassist, a drummer, someone singing, and you were two blokes with a drum machine and a guitar and a lot to say. How was that when that started to blow up and you had to fill these stages and fill these expectations?
There was definitely a moment, I don't know when it would have been, but I don't think, like, John Fat Beast, he was kind of known for just for coming on and introducing us and people shouting "you fat bastard" at him. But originally, when we first met him, he did the lights at the Bull and Gate in Kentish Town. He also he promoted and he did the lights, and that's how we met him, by doing gigs there. And he was constantly saying that we needed to get a light, some sort of light show, even when we were playing sort of relatively small gigs. And he just kind of muscled his way in and just did the lights. He would just turn up, regardless of whether we wanted him to. So it was because of him. So I think we did need a light show.
It made a difference, right? Again, this is so weird, all the parallels. Me and Dan Lesac were, again, a two-piece, and it was only on our last tour that we got a lighting guy to come on tour with us, and I was fuming that we hadn't done it our whole career. Because it was always that thing, oh, it's an expense that we can't really justify, blah, 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 we're touring out of a van, all this. But the difference it made to our live show on those bigger stages, on those, you know, 1-2,000 cap venues rather than the 2-300 cap venues. Yeah, that last tour we ever did was easily the best tour we ever did, and it was because we got a good lighting guy on board. And I love that you had someone who didn't really give you a choice, just started coming and going, I've got this covered, like, lads.
It was everything we did was like that, really.
Yeah,
but we had the bloke who did it when we played Wembley Arena with The Cure, and and it was quite a sort of big gig. And somebody different did the lights. He was a friend of John B's. And he did the lights. And then after the gig, I think it was in a bar somewhere, he said, do you know, that's the first time I ever touched a lighting desk. But he just sort of bullshitted his way into...
Amazing.
And now he does lights for, like, everyone, you know.
Yeah, I mean, his first ever gig was at Wembley, so that's not a bad start.
So,
I love that. But have you got any favourite or worst memories from those days of big headline tours and big festival shows? And as you say, things like playing Wembley with The Cure, for fuck's sake, and stuff like that. What comes to mind when you think back at all?
I think most of the sort of the gigs that were like when we were kind of on the way up. So, like, when we played Wembley with The Cure, we were on the way up. When we sort of went on second to top of the bill at Reading, it felt like everybody loved us at the time.
Yeah.
And then sort of, so probably like a year later or something, we'd kind of peaked. It was, so didn't think it at the time, but presumably the next, you know, there's only one way to go after that, isn't it? You either become, two ways.
Yeah.
You become bigger or you go back down again. So I think, so like by the time we headline Glastonbury, you know, which some people can't believe, but we headline Glastonbury. But it's, I do remember,
amazing,
but by that point, it wasn't so enjoyable because I've sort of got this memory of, I mean, apart from the fact we were ejected from the site by Michael Eavis just for complaining about everything. But
oh, really? Yeah. How can you eject the headliners for complaining?
I mean, it was because because the whole thing overran, because we were on last, we had to cut our set, and it was a real sort of, so we ended up a big row about that. And then they let Fruitback go back on just to let everyone know, sorry, we had to leave it, you know, because of curfew and all that. But he went on and he just slagged off the whole festival for not letting the travellers in and all this kind of stuff. So then they came back to the sort of portal cabin and asked us to leave.
Amazing. What a way to go out.
But the other thing, absolutely, yeah. But the other thing I remember was that it's a sort of vague memory, but I had this memory of looking out at this massive crowd and being aware that not everybody likes us. Do you know what I mean? Whereas at Reading a year before, it felt like everybody here thinks we're the best band in the world. You know, obviously that's a bit delusional, but at Glastonbury, I was sort of very aware that, well, you know, those 20,000 people over there absolutely hate us.
Yeah.
Or are disinterested. So everything from that point, maybe, you know, you're sort of less. Yeah, success is a weird sort of thing, isn't it? When you sort of, success.
It really can be. Early on the podcast, I had Billy Bragg on and he spoke about the amount of people he knows who have had real struggles with their mental health because they've achieved their dream, their childhood dream.
Yeah.
And they've kind of felt, all right, well, there we go then.
What
now? And it didn't give them the fulfillment. Billy says he's lucky because it has given him that. He's kind of, each time he is like, this is amazing. I can't believe I get to do this. But it's a mad one. It must be really odd. Because as I said, in that era in particular, I mean, all eras, headlining Glastonbury is the absolute peak of the music industry, really. So to have done that and have those feelings, it must have been a really odd...
Yeah.
Odd anticlimax, I guess. Again, I'm sure amazing as well, but an odd anticlimax to go, oh, wow, that was it then.
Yeah. Because I'm sort of annoyed at myself that I feel like that in a way, or that I felt like that.
Yeah.
Because it was the same when we had a number one album. I remember that being not disappointing, but not as great as it should be. Because it was almost because it was a foregone conclusion. Because, you know, the record label were telling us it's going to be number one. And they sort of worked out how it was going to be number one. And that. Whereas before,
ruined the surprise.
Yeah. Before everything was like, I remember like getting in the indie charts or whatever with a single or an album just sort of blew my mind at first, you know.
It's mad how unrelenting the industry is, isn't it? Because no matter how positively you come in, I think it's quite quick that the way the industry is built, it's quite quick to make you think, oh, we've got in the chart, but who's above us this time?
Oh, yeah.
And where should we have got? And where did we chart last time? And even if you're number one, but how many did the last person who was number one sell? And where's the singles of this album charted and things like that? Which is horrible, because as you say, early days, I was like, I've got a record in HMV.
Yeah.
Like, I worked in HMV for years. For me, it was like I'd walk into HMVs genuinely just look at it. I'd go in and go to our section and go, they've printed out a fucking header card and everything. This is mad. But then I said, a second album. I'm looking at, have we got Radio 1 playlist again? Have we got this? Have we got that?
Yeah.
And it's ugly, man. It's so hard to avoid because it becomes a job. It becomes an industry rather than a passion.
Later on, like much later on, like now, you sort of realise that there's a better way of doing things.
Yeah, yeah.
But even that's not necessarily good enough. But you kind of realise that, I don't know, some of those things aren't as important as they seem at the time, maybe.
I tell this story all the time, but when I had a record label, I've kind of wrapped it up now, but we would always celebrate a new release when the artwork was submitted. So the artwork and the music has been submitted, it's going off to press. That was when we celebrated, rather than when it came out or when it did whatever it did in the charts or whatever else. Like, no, we've done this. That is the point to go, fucking hell, we've got a record here. And I think that's the way to do it, man. Because everything else becomes nonsense and distracted and comparative to other people.
Or then everything else is like cherries and sprinkles.
Yeah, completely. It's all a bonus. I remember when we put this album out by a guy, Giacomo Brown, it was so uncommercial, and he doesn't play live, doesn't do interviews, anything. I remember when we got a good review in Uncut, and a good review on Six Music, in fact. It was on one of the round table shows, and they spoke nicely of it. It was like, oh shit, we were kind of expecting that, well, at least it's out. At least it got released. So to get good responses was exactly that. It was a huge cherry on top. So yeah, definitely the way to go. Well, I mean, speaking of the kind of things that come with coverage or fame or success, two things I want to talk about. I want to talk about legal battles with the Rolling Stones and physical battles with Philip Schofield. So how was that to suddenly find yourselves on the kind of the music side of it, having a band as big as the Rolling Stones with legal teams as big as the Rolling Stones going, oi, that's our lyric, or that's our, in a part that references, you know, something from them. How was that period for you guys?
I think, I mean, because that was, a lot of that stuff happened in a very sort of, in a sort of intense period of time, which was pretty much when we signed to a major label, which was when they started asking permission the first two albums are full of, like, there's, you know, we sampled Elvis, Bowie, you know, just all this stuff. No one ever noticed. So but as soon as we said, we'll have to ask permission.
On my first album, I sampled or ripped off a whole bit of a Kate Bush song. And on the album that I put out with Cooking Vinyl, that was a proper album, I covered that same Kate Bush song and gave her 100%, like, got clearance and gave her 100%. And I never really told him. I was like, that was kind of to make up for the fact that I'd stolen it in my youth when I didn't know anything about it. It's like, well, I'll cover it officially now. And you can have all of the...
Because with the Rolling Stones thing, that was because we did the Goodbye Ruby Tuesday line. That was because at the time, that was my favourite Rolling Stones record.
Yeah.
So it was done from a sort of fan's point of view, really, putting it in there. I didn't put it in there because I hated the Rolling Stones. And then it was a sort of weird thing because we were being sued by their publishing company more than by the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, of course.
So I think the only disappointing time was when Mick Jagger was asked about it in an interview, and he started talking about you can't let people set precedents or something. Like, I found that a bit disappointing in a way. So, you know,
a bit industry.
Yeah, he could have sort of... Because there was a David Bowie... There was a thing with a sort of... Somebody had discovered that we'd used a David Bowie sample for Suffragette City years before, and the company wanted to do something about it, and David Bowie stepped in and said, no, just doesn't matter, kind of.
Right, that's amazing.
So that's what he could have... So Mick Jagger could have said, but I mean, he could have said it's nothing to do with me, which was true.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we thought, oh yeah, we're going to win this battle. And then it was only when our lawyer said, you know, you'll never win this battle because this company has got so much money.
Yeah.
That we could, you know, we could go to court, but we would have to have, you know, we'd have to put hundreds of thousands of pounds for this stupid sort of battle. So we just dealt with it the way we dealt with all things, was just with sarcasm. So I think we sort of agreed to, I think it got, the single got deleted or whatever they call it. And we did, like, the videos came out, and like a collection of our promo videos. And that one, after the Watershed, was renamed after the court case. And there's no audio on it. It's just pictures. So it's just that sort of childish reaction to it.
Yeah.
But
that's perfect. Yeah.
I was going to say, Philip Schofield thing was for that record. So all these things were happening. So obviously seemed a bit insane at the time.
Was he skipping a queue and you guys were just ahead of the time and saw him for what he is, as he's had all the drama now?
I don't know. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't have a massive problem with him, mainly because I don't watch This Morning. So I don't, and you know, and he was kind of, in years after, he was quite sort of nice about it. He wasn't sort of, you know, so, and I've
basically
seen...
Basically, Fruitbat Rugby tackled him at the Smash Hit Awards, is that the...
I mean, yeah, it's basically, I mean, people say rugby tackle. I mean, I think really if you actually watch the video clip, I think it's actually pretty horrible. It's like quite, it's violent. It's not, there's a lot of anger from Fruitbat. He doesn't sort of run on a hilariously rugby tackle. It's more like he's come and he's tried to kill him. That's yeah. I think that, you know, not kill him, but you know, he's not, he's properly angry.
Yeah.
He's not just doing it for a jape.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I didn't, at the time, I didn't think it was funny at all. Well, I didn't see it because I'd already stormed off the stage. Right. So, but that was part, I think that was part of us that whole day, and that us sort of feeling like we were betraying our kind of, our sort of roots or whatever, or we were selling out. That's what it felt like, you know, the whole sort of, it was very, all too show business for us, the whole event.
It's weird, isn't it, on those things? And again, it plays into getting caught up in the industry and things I like that, because I think there's been so many instances over the years of bands playing at that kind of thing, but wanting to prove that they're not the kind of people to play at that kind of thing. And it's like, with the greatest respect, it's like, well, don't play it then kind of thing. And it is, it's that weird thing of, if you find yourself in that situation, then you're like, well, what do we do?
I think that was the way it was, possibly what it was the most annoying thing about it at the time, was that the people said that we sort of deliberately set it up, that we planned on doing it. Yeah. As opposed to, you know, Fruitbat just being really drunk and just lost his temper, you know, which is, it was in no way planned. And, you know, as you say, we wouldn't have, you know, we did turn things down. We wouldn't, so we would have just not done it.
Yeah.
We were kind of, you get talked into things by record labels, and you to, you know, this, you've got to do this. And if they hadn't done all the, you know, because we had stupid things like we would sort of insist on, okay, we'll do it, but you mustn't fade the song down because it makes us look stupid because we're miming, because we hated hated looking, don't mind miming, but when you're really obviously miming, it's a bit sort of, and then all, they just faded it down really quickly, just sort of, so that's why he, so that was why he was initially annoyed, so he kicked a couple of things over, and then Philip Schofield made a sarcastic comment, and that sort of tipped him over the but if they hadn't have faded it down, Philip Schofield wouldn't have had to say something sarcastic and none of it would have happened. But
exactly. Well, I mean, well, another thing I wanted to talk about, because it, again, it's a memory I have of my brother and his mates all being into it at the time, and it's something I relate to, is covers. Because when we used to tour, we'd always have a different cover song on each tour, because I was just a music fan who couldn't believe I was getting to do this. And I know probably most of the fans had no desire to see me cover the Specials or cover Prince or cover the Sugar Babes on one tour, but it was exciting for me to, because these are songs I love. You guys used to have covers as B-sides and stuff a lot. What kind of inspired that? Was that part of you kind of going, looking back at you, as you say, your kind of eclectic music taste growing up and the different areas you got into? What drew you to do covers regularly?
I think, I mean, part of it, in terms of recording with them, it was, part of it was for fun, because we didn't, you know, there was no pressure to write lyrics or anything, you know, so we were just, let's just do someone else's song. And also kind of showing, you know, our influences, as you say, you know, so we, if we do a Pet Shop Boys song, it's because we love the Pet Shop Boys, not because we're taking the piss out of the Pet Shop Boys. But maybe it's unexpected, even though similarities were obvious to me. Or those sort of things. Or, you know, we did a Soft Cell song because we loved Soft Cell.
I love that. And I completely relate, because there is, anytime you're doing music that's kind of unusual for the time, and that time it was kind of, you know, is very different, you assume all your influences will come across, but they don't always. So it is kind of nice to go, oh no. Like, I always remember when our first single came out, it was called Thou Shalt Always Kill, and it got in the charts, and it was a big surprise. And it was all lovely, but what was really lovely was any time punks were into it. Because I grew up into punk, and I felt this was so far from punk, but I grew up, punk was my biggest influence. So anytime punks were into it and were like, yeah, it's got the vibe of this, although it's electronic, although it's this and that, it meant the world to me anytime it was punks enjoying it. Because, like, that's in there somewhere. It's somewhere in my DNA, and that's come across. So,
And also, I think of something we did, because we did a cover of The Impossible Dream, which might seem like an unusual song, but that's a song that me and Les used to do that busking in Croydon.
Oh, wow.
You know, to sort of, so, you know, we were really into show tunes, like songs from musicals was something that we sort of loved. And that, you know, I can hear that in some of the Carter stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they're always wanting to have an orchestra, but never being able to afford one or whatever. So, like, using synthesizers to kind of create that sort of similar massive over the top thing.
Completely. It's the beauty of it. Ian McKay of Minor Threat and Fugazi and all that always used to say, I always remember reading a quote of his and saying, I'd much rather hear four guys that have such huge ambitions of what they want to get across but don't necessarily have the technical skill or the orchestras or whatever than someone who's got access to everything and all of this that can just do what they want. It's like, no, it's what's bursting to get out through the means that they have is what makes it exciting. And that 100% comes across in Carter's stuff.
We were rubbish basically, but
so I mean, you spoke about the kind of feeling after headlining Glastonbury, it was all downhill from there. When did it come to an end? What was when, where, why? What was the kind of journey to go in, you know what, this ain't happening anymore?
I think, well, after we, there was a point where we got a drummer, which sort of changed everything, obviously. And then we sort of, you know, we made an album as a three piece, and it was, so already we sounded different. We didn't sound like this. We didn't sound like the same band at all. So I don't know, maybe commercially that was a mistake commercially, but it felt like the right thing to do at the time. And then that led to us being a six piece by the end, you know, because we just sort of started just picking up other members, because we found that it was I think we were basically bored with the drum machine and that.
Yeah.
And so we were probably sort of around that, whenever that would have been, like the past couple of years, the last 2 years of Carter were probably less, I was probably less excited about the whole thing.
Yeah.
So we just kept changing stuff, and then the gigs were just getting, they get emptier and smaller, and I found that sort of incredibly depressing.
Yeah.
And then doing stuff, you know, just doing, you know, before we always just did pretty much what we wanted to do and no compromise, and it all just seemed to work. Whereas then it was, you know, last few years were just all compromise, you know, and just sort of doing, had like a massive tax bill. So we had to do gigs at university balls at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning, playing to drunk judges or whatever.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. So everything was just, it was just less fun.
And again, you've got it all the wrong way around, that you're adding band members when the crowds are going down. That's just going to cost you more.
And then you end up in a, I think we ended up, when there were, you know, we did that thing that everybody does at the end of, well, not everybody, a lot of people do at the end of bands, just let's go to America for a long tour. And then everyone just really falls out in America.
Been there.
So maybe that's just the, maybe that's the way things are supposed to happen.
Yeah.
But I think because there were six of us, and most of those people were having a really good time because it was new to them, and they'd just been brought in for, they were essentially on holiday, whereas I was sort of, you know, I wasn't on holiday. I was on the opposite of a holiday.
Yeah.
And I was paying for the holiday. That was the worst thing. You know, that's, you know, I paid for the tour bus because Fruitbat spent all his money. I was a bit more careful with money. So I ended up paying. So I was paying the tax bills for both of us.
Yeah. Wow.
And then I was hiring the tour bus so that everyone could have a holiday in America while I was like miserable.
Yeah. So that was always going to be impossible to enjoy, right?
Yeah.
Because you know the cost at which it comes, the financial cost and the mental cost and all this.
I think just because I was quite, I'm not very good at confrontation of any sort of type. So I just never had the courage to tell everyone, you know.
Yeah.
If I was Neil Young or something, I just would have walked off or just sacked everybody. Just emailed them and said, yeah, sorry, you're all sacked. So it just took me a long time to pluck up the courage to say, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, and then, of course, everyone's like, what? Why?
Yeah, it's mad how in those situations, again, it's so weird. The one American tour that we did, I wrote out a resignation letter. I never ended up sending it, and we ended up doing tours after that, and it was much better, and things got better. But that period, it's mad how you can be with people so much, but communication can break down so much. So everything that's been going on in your head, the other five people weren't aware of. So when you do turn around and go, it's over, in your mind, it's inevitable. Everyone knew this was coming. But to a lot of them, it's a genuine shock. Going, what? I thought we're... Oh.
Yeah. The only time I'm ever sort of brutally honest to probably too honest, is on stage when I sort of get a bit carried away. And I do remember at those American gigs, I would say things during the gig to the audience that pretty much was, you know, I'd say, well, you know, this is the last time we'll ever play this, that sort of thing. But no one noticed. Yeah. No one in the band noticed. Yeah. That I'm just telling everyone. Yeah, we're splitting the band up at the end of this.
Yeah.
But people didn't tend to notice. I don't know.
I mean, I kind of want to, we're up to an hour now, so I don't want to take up your whole day. But when did your feelings towards it all change? Because you guys have had numerous reunion shows and events and tours and things like that. And it feels like it kind of happened at a point when you just had to get comfortable with everything and maybe let go of certain things that had plagued you for a while. And it feels like you just need to get in a better a place. So kind of how was the kind of the getting back together, the giving it back to the crowd again?
So it would have been like 10 years, I suppose, between last gig and reunion. So just as soon as the band split up, I was like, personally, I was doing solo stuff or trying to do solo stuff immediately. So all the things that I'd wanted to do probably for a year before, I just went straight into. So tried various things and did various solo albums, you know, pretty much all of them commercially, everything unsuccessful, I'd say, you know. And especially compared to what had gone before. And then some things that were kind of did quite well and did do some fairly decent sort of solo gigs. But there was always that thing, people would always ask, you know, whether it be promoters or fans or whatever, always asking, you know, why didn't you get the band together?
Yeah.
And it's something that we always said no to. And then I think maybe there was a point where Fruitbat wanted to do it or was up for doing it, but I just say more and more. If I was ever asked in interviews, I always used to say more and more stupid things, you know, like I'd rather cut my own legs off, that kind of, you know, just sort of as a sort of get out. But I think always at the back of my mind, I knew that no one was really offering any sort of decent, no one was offering a lot of money or anything like that. So it wasn't really a sort of a big deal to say, no, we're never going to do it. But then, so it was whatever year that was, 2007, or the singer from Megacity 4 died.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody organised a gig where all the sort of bands from that era, like Senseless Things and Therapy and I can't remember who else was on, would do like four songs for Wiz, and it was called Four for Wiz. And they wanted me and Les to get back together and just to do it acoustically. Art songs, and we were still friends and that. We were going to do that. Actually, I mean, at the time, I was doing some Carter songs as a solo thing, and I thought Les will say no, and I'll just do it on my own. This will be easy. I'll just turn up and do four songs. But he said, "No, let's do it, but I don't want to do it acoustic." So I was like, "Oh, fucking hell, you're joking." So, so I kind of got talked into doing it by Les, so we ended up doing four songs with. I think we had an MP3 player at this point, so it's off, which didn't work. And we did four songs, and it was just the reception to it. I can't remember where it was. I think it was the Islington Academy or something like that.
Right.
I've forgotten where the gig was. But yeah, the reception from the audience was just so insane to us coming on and doing four songs.
Yeah.
That kind of led on to some promoters suggesting it seriously. And then my manager, Mark, is... he's now sort of Carter's manager as well, but he now sells all the t-shirts for all those bands you mentioned earlier. He's the mastermind behind that.
Brilliant.
He's the king of the bullshitters. He's just an insane, I don't know, marketing genius in just that he would. So he lied to us about Live Nation offering us a certain amount of money to do Brixton Academy. And, it wasn't strictly true. They'd offered us like money if we sold it out, but he told us it was guaranteed. So anyway, that's the sort of boring side of it. So we ended up, we got talked into doing that and over to Glasgow Barrowlands.
Yeah.
And I think because we did it, I mean, there's a lot of things involved in doing two gigs. There's quite a lot involved, isn't it? That you wouldn't, you know, just finding somebody to do the sound and the lights and stuff like that. Because everyone's
particularly after so long off.
Yeah, because they're all busy doing other stuff. So all that was sort of difficult, and then rehearsing was really weird, unusual because we hadn't sort of rehearsed together on our own. Sort of, but then once we'd done it, we realised, you know, we really enjoyed it. And wouldn't it be good to do it again?
Yeah.
And then we sort of fell into this thing of doing it, did it either once every year or once every other year, but just doing two gigs.
Yeah.
And sort of, and, you know, financially it was fine. I'm not gonna lie about that. I wouldn't have done it for nothing. But it was kind of, and they were quite joyous events. Everybody who went there knew what was going to happen. Yeah. There weren't going to be any new songs. Yeah. They were going to hear the old songs played as they were played at the time, sometimes with the same tapes.
Yeah.
I think the first, like, there's two songs. No, yeah, one or two songs that we played at the very first gig, that gig when we didn't really exist, that we used the same cassette tape.
Wow.
At the last ever gig, we were still, we put it onto DAT or something, or onto whatever we were using then. But it still had all the hiss because it was still the same.
I love that.
But that's beautiful. I think it's just that thing. It was an enjoy. It was a great, celebratory thing, events to be at. And then maybe there came a point where we thought, oh, this, you can't just keep doing this forever.
Yeah.
So we had to sort of stop.
Yeah. I love that though. So tell me about where you are now. What have you been working on in the studio? What's going on basically?
Well, I did for quite a while, I just concentrated on books and did the however many, six novels or something. And I wasn't writing songs at all. I didn't write a song for about 7 years, I think. And then I started writing for some reason. I can't remember why. I wrote some songs. I want to say, no, it was pre-COVID. But I wrote some songs and then I recorded them with a band. I don't know if I'm remembering this right. But basically, I did a gig. Me and my manager, Mark, who's like, we both sort of get over ambitious ideas. And we went to see, I played the 100 Club and sold it out.
Yeah.
And that was sort of biggest gig I'd done around that time, I suppose, in London. And then we went to see Conor Oberst at London Palladium.
Yeah.
And we were sitting there waiting for him to come on. And I just said, do you think I could play here? And we just sort of started talking about that. And that led to us convincing a promoter to put me on at Shepherd's Bush Empire.
Amazing.
Even though, and it was totally stupid, but and sold it out. So,
wow.
So that sort of, I'm trying to remember how these things happen. So then went back to Shepherd's Bush Empire, like again after that, but this time brought on like a band for some of the songs, band of people who I knew who played with a friend of mine, Chris TT. I don't know if you know Chris TT. So it was his band basically. And then this is the most boring long answer ever, but basically as a result of playing with this band, I wanted to record with a band. So I ended up writing some songs and then ended up. So now I'm on the third album with them, but the last two, I think one of them was number 26 in the chart. So it was, you know, it was, they did well. So, so it's kind of all kicked off again. So the one I'm with, so I've been recording a new album with them, which, everybody says this, I'm sure, but genuinely, it's the first time I've ever thought that this is the best album I've ever done. That sort of, I genuinely do. I've kidded myself in the past. I've said that, but knowing, no, it's not really. But I genuinely think it is. So it will be a shame when it doesn't do as well as it should do.
Oh, of course, of course. Now it's going to be the most unsuccessful, most poorly received.
That is the thing. You know, so if I could stop now, knowing that I think that. That would probably be a good time to stop.
Yeah.
You know, rather than I know that when it'll come out, I'll be like, oh no, Six Music don't want to play it.
It's one of the reasons I stopped when I did, because mine and Dan Lesak's last album was the one I was most proud of artistically. It did well commercially. And I was like, cool, let's leave it there. Like it's not like it got to number one in the charts or anything, but it did well. We did good tours. And I was like, all right, it's balanced. Like we've finally got there. And I'm happy with that. Let's run off into the sunset and not ruin it.
Well, that's probably the best thing you could have done.
I think so. Well, mate, I appreciate you coming on and having a chat. It's been an absolute joy, and it's flown by. So yeah, thank you for coming in.
It's good to see you. We should meet up every 10 years.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. We'll get another catch up. We'll see if you've had any joys or letdowns in the next 10 years and where it all lands.
Yeah, if I'm still alive in 10 years.
Perfect. Well, thank you for taking the time, mate. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Jim Bob of, amongst other things, Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine. I'll be back next week with more wonderful chat. A little reminder, almost everything at speechdevelopmentrecords.com is 27% off at the moment. So go and fill your boots there if you fancy it. But don't spend money you've not got. As said, none of my merch is essential or important. I mean, it's dope, but it's not essential or important. So, yeah. I hope you're all well and holding up okay in these strange times. Until next week, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.